This is the second part of an interview with Bud Hopkins. We've been talking about his 40 or more years' experience as an abduction researcher. Bud, what inspired you to write such a personal book?
One of the things, of course, about the memoir that I've written, Art, Life, and UFOs, is the fact that I've written four books on the UFO subject, on essentially on particular cases and particular aspects of the subject. And that's the book writing I've done, four of them, and they're separated by a lot of years from the first to the last. Because I don't think of myself essentially as an author, as a book writer. I mean, some people who are sort of professional writers grind them out. I've written many books. Whitney Strieber, there are a number of people who are just produce huge numbers of books. That's not myself. So as a painter, you know, I don't consider that writing a profession. But finally, I decided that I wanted to do a kind of summing up in my memoir. Hitting a certain very heavy-duty age, I felt it's about time I get a lot of things down that to me seem to be valuable experiences. So when I wrote the memoir, I saw it as a completely different kind of book, anything I've done before, and it's in a sort of special category. But I felt that there were several things I wanted to do. One is I wanted to present a certain kind of slice of social history that I lived through that maybe a lot of people haven't lived through yet. For instance, what it was like to be a little boy during World War II. With my father in the army, and I was playing with soldiers and had a sort of glamorized view of the war at the beginning. And I wanted to kind of get that clear, plus also the politics of the situation that I grew up in. And people now, in a more generally, in a more liberal time, at least more sophisticated time, can possibly not imagine the degree of bigotry and actually ignorance that I lived through as a child with a small town kind of provincial existence. I wanted to bring all that out because I felt they were valuable experiences. And I, of course, wanted to bring out how I became an artist, really. So these are just some of the reasons why I wrote the book and why it's so different than anything else I've written.
And it really is very, very nice to read, because what really comes across, apart from being very, very fascinating, going from that period, your life as a small child, you overcoming the polio, and you describe all of those instances so beautifully, and it's the warmth and compassion that you do have for your fellow humans really comes across in the book. And then you do lead into how you became involved in the UFO abduction experience, and you give some very, very interesting cases in there. One that I do want to ask you, in 1989, where an abduction took place, and there were a lot of witnesses, and it almost seemed as if it was deliberately done that way.
Yes, that was the case that I wrote about and witnessed. And the thing is that That was again, nighttime case. The witness case was extremely different because of the fact that the aliens in this particular instance seemed to want to show off what they could do. And so what happened is they stopped a procession of cars full of officials. They were heading down to Governor's Island for another diplomatic meeting, and this came at the very, very crucial time in the world when the Berlin Wall was coming down, the Russian Empire was just breaking up, and there was a lot of international anxiety and chaos and so forth. So these official cars were driving towards a helicopter base at the roof of Manhattan Island, And suddenly the whole procession stopped because there was some kind of electrical interference. The aliens can do this whatever they want to. And as they stopped, not knowing what was happening, all of a sudden, a UFO above a nearby apartment building turned out all its lights, evidently. There were other witnesses who described this as looking like a movie being made, a sci-fi movie. They didn't know what was happening. And amazingly, a woman, who was the central figure in the book, and three small aliens came floating out of the 12-story window in a bright beam of light so that everybody could see. As if the people who were the officials in the car stopped below, including some very high-ranking diplomatic figures, could see the alien power in full range. And Linda Cortillo, the woman who floated out with the three aliens, were then sort of floated up into the craft, and the craft zoomed away. But it was as if a little show was being put on. This took place in, a minute or two, I suppose. And then the cars were able to move again. It's an extremely complicated story, the most complex case I've ever looked into because of the number of witnesses and the way this thing unfolded, with a couple of security agents being very deeply involved in it, who were some of the witnesses down below, but it also emerged that they too were abducted along with Linda Cortillo that night. It's just an extraordinary story, but I spent years on it and found so many different witnesses to different aspects of it that it's as witness laden as anything I've ever heard of in the field.
What amazes me though about that is that it managed to get as little press coverage as it did. It sort of really covered that up quite well.
Well, I think that one of the reasons it got little coverage was, first of all, Linda Cortillo did not want to come public. This involved also one of her sons. And they did not want to come publicly to testify. And nor did the agents involved want to come public. So the whole thing was unfortunately sort of bereft of personal witnesses. One of the witnesses who saw this thing unfold from her car, which has also been stopped, which is on the Brooklyn Bridge, did not want to come public, and I had to go meet her kind of secretly, but she allowed me to tape the interview with her. But people were so shocked by this that they simply did not want to come forward. And, of course, when you're telling a tremendously complex story and a story which is sort of on the surface extremely difficult to accept, and you don't have witnesses that are willing to, show their faces and tell their stories, and then you have problems getting credibility and coverage. In other words, the New York Times would not have covered a story like this, dramatic as it is, unless they could actually interview some of the people involved, and that was actually impossible at the time.
You talk about also how you remember being a child, and you remember the whole Orson Welles radio broadcast. Do you think that had a detrimental effect? Because now we're talking about this incident. It's almost as if people obviously don't want to come out and say they saw it because, one, it's terrifying and it's very bizarre, and they don't want to be open to ridicule. And sort of what comes to mind is the Orson Welles episode.
Well, I think, I think that's very true, that the reaction people had to the Orson Welles program when they realized that their terror and if anything, the panic reactions that have surfaced about that radio broadcast amongst people who took it totally literally, that reactions that have surfaced are probably only the tip of the iceberg, because that's not something people want to admit to. if they did something weird, like, as I mentioned, a man phoned my father during the program saying he was putting his wife and kids in the car. He was loading the car with food and water and rifles and ammunition and going up on a hill to make a stand. Well, we found out about that because he called my father during the program. And probably around the whole country there were people doing panic-stricken things like that. So the degree of panic was, if anything, has been wildly underestimated from that program. And that meant that once it was revealed as a hoax, in effect, nobody wanted to be burned twice. Nobody wanted to accept anything, that even that they saw with their own eyes, as being legitimate and reported, because they didn't want the ridicule, and they assumed that somehow or other this can't be real either. So the Orson Welles program had a long-term deleterious effect on the field itself, unfortunately.
Yes, and certainly I would think it would prevent people from wanting to come forward.
Absolutely.
But what are some of your favorite stories you've told in the book?
Well, there are many things. Of course, in the art world, there's so many memories I had about the 1950s. The whole abstract expressionist world as it unfolded, which I participated in, and I, as an abstract expressionist painter, the whole art world was extremely small. I thought these people, when I began meeting them, the painters, were very well known, or which they were within a very, very tiny world. But the art world was about 250 people. And there was a bar that everybody went to, the Cedar Street Tavern bar. And people gathered there like a club. It was like a poor man's club that one went to just to relax and drink beer and talk with friends. So the memories of that and the stories are very, you know, to me, very, very rich. I think some of the account there, I've actually met and discussed some friends who read what I'd written and who were there at the time. And, you know, the way that, because of the situation being so vivid, these were very vivid personalities. Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, Mark Rothko, Franz Klein, and so forth, that I've written about in a personal way. When I stirred up the memories of a few friends who were there at the time, it's such a rich time in terms of humor and which was shared, and despair, and because people didn't have any money, and there was a lot of drinking and alcoholism, but the mixture of all of these factors, which were so rich, along with the tremendous creativity of the paintings. I don't know whether people listening may have seen the Ed Harris movie on Jackson Pollock, which was, I thought, a very, very fine film. Might have a sense of the texture of those years. There, I mean, things were funny, and things were despairing, and in a very, very touching mix.
Yes, you certainly convey that very, very well in the book. You also talk about some other very interesting people that you had encounters with, Kurt Vonnegut, Carl Sagan, and also Lawrence Rockefeller.
Well, Lawrence Rockefeller was very brief. I saw him a few times. I've forgotten how many times I actually was face-to-face with him, maybe four or five times. But I did spend the night in his house in Botanical Hills, and the whole thing was about that was funny was, of course, one thinks of the Rockefellers as somehow up on a totally different plane than all the rest of us, which, of course, is true. But when we all went to bed, it was David Jacobs and John Mack and myself having a kind of meeting with Lawrence Rockefeller about the UFO abduction phenomenon, which he was very interested in. And when he assigned his bedrooms in his mansion, really, up at Botanical Hills, said we'd get up at 7 in the morning and resume our conversations. Said he was heading to his office later on in the day, but there was no alarm clock in my room as I looked around. And I called him. He was still up. He was downstairs. And I said, Lawrence, we don't have, there's no alarm clock up there. And he said to me, don't worry about it, but I'll get you up at 7. So at 7 o'clock, you're in a house that I, of course, in my imagination, thought would be swarming with butlers and servants and so forth, and alarm clocks. I was awakened by Lawrence outside my door and his very patrician voice. He was an elderly man. It's calling my name, Abad, Abad, it's time to get up. This is a bizarre experience for me to have, to be in the Rockefeller Mansion and have a Rockefeller himself waking me up. But, I mean, it was just a humorous thing and that I put in the book and very sweet. And incidentally, I wanted very much for the book to have relieving bits of humor through it, because humor is another one of those lubricants of life that helps us get through it.
Absolutely. You also mentioned you had encounters with Carl Sagan.
Well, the Sagan thing, that was an ongoing thing, and I've written kind of a long piece about it in the book. These are like little, I mean, some of these things are sort of portrait sketches, you might say, in words about some of these people. But Sagan I met originally when I found myself on a television program in the Boston area I thought was just going to be about the abduction phenomenon. And I had a woman with me who was willing to be on the program and go forward about her own abduction experiences. And in the green room before the program, I was told by a nervous producer that Carl Sagan was going to be on the program with me. And my heart sank, I have to say, because Sagan at that point was showing up on the Johnny Carson program frequently, and he had his own series on PBS. And was, you know, world famous, and was world famous as a skeptic on the subject. And I was certain that I was in a terrible spot here, because whatever I'm going to say is going to have absolutely no weight. And the worst part of it is I was told we would be on separate segments, so there wouldn't be any kind of dialogue where I could defend myself, and that they were putting me on first, and then Sagan, which of course would let him have the last word and demolish or try to whatever I would say about the phenomenon. But the theme was, with all those worries, suddenly this man approached me who seemed to be very different than the Carl Sagan I'd seen on television. He introduced himself as Carl Sagan and said, "You're Bud Hopkins, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I've read your book." I knew that Alan Hynek had sent him a copy of Missing Time. But at any rate, at that point, we were often running in a discussion. But what happened is I found that on a personal level and on a political level, we hit it off. He was politically liberal, and he was very friendly. At any rate, the program went on, and afterwards there was an ongoing series of letters and exchanges with Sagan. I think that I really sort of threw him something that was impossible for him to answer. He said to me, which was a sort of mantra of the skeptics, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. And I said, "Well, Carl, it seems to me that all of the UFO sightings and by military, so and all the radar and visual sightings combined, all of the reports of abductions that are extraordinarily similar and end up with people having extraordinarily similar scars, these scoop marks where sampling has been taken, etc. I said, all of this together, you'd have to say whatever you think caused it constitutes an extraordinary experience. But he said, yes, extraordinary phenomenon. And he said, yes, it is. He agreed. And I said, well, then shouldn't we be saying an extraordinary phenomenon demands an extraordinary investigation? I said, you should be looking into this, not me. And it really took him aback because he didn't really know what to say. But this sort of set off an ultimate series of letters and at least verbal conversations written, confrontations. It was a very complex, and I've written about it. It's very hard for me right now in just a few words to kind of sum up the complexity of my relationship with him.
Well, right. And, but I understand that. Why do you think he was so skeptical?
Well, see, that's the interesting thing. I mean, to run it down, one thing could be it was just his natural bias against something like this. But that doesn't really hold water because he really had such a powerful belief in the existence of extraterrestrial life. It was intelligent life. So it wasn't that. But I think that there was a huge fear of losing his status in the scientific community and possibly losing government contracts and so forth. It's also the possibility that he knew about the truth about UFOs and somehow felt that it was his duty to continue with some kind of cover-up that's had been in place officially for years, which I believe is the case. And I'll throw one more thing into the hopper. It's possible that he had had some kind of UFO experience himself, whether it's a sighting or whatever, and knew the truth and was so frightened by the whole thing that denial seemed to be the easiest way out. I don't have any idea which of these hypotheses is true, but certainly something of that along the lines of one of those things.
Interesting. Now, you also had an encounter or encounters with Kurt Vonnegut. How was he on the whole UFO phenomenon?
Well, that was a major disappointment. When I first met him through a friend and we all went out to dinner, he came down to the studio. His first wife was a painter, too, and so he had an interest in painting. So when I first met him, this was before I'd had a sighting or anything, and we went out to dinner. We had a very, very nice time. And, of course, he's a very fascinating man, very bright. And when I met him the second time, and at that point, the UFO subject came up because I had, at that point, come out publicly and being involved with the subject and had written a book. He was absolutely cold on the UFO subject and thought there was nothing to it and put the whole thing down. Which was shocking to me, but you know, I had this idea maybe that science fiction writers, and of course that's only one aspect of his literary work, but science fiction writers maybe don't like to hear about UFOs because they're interested in constructing their own extraterrestrial world very often, and they want it to be completely under their control, and if there's such a thing as UFOs flying around and the possibility of there being extraterrestrial and so on, it kind of muddies the waters for them. And so they seem more committed to looking away from it, just somehow ignoring it. And I ran into this same situation with Ray Bradbury, who's had written some, important science fiction stuff. He didn't know anything about it at all. Like, it was as if he had turned his back on it all his life. I would have thought that the two of them would have been very interested in the UFO material, but it was the opposite.
Perhaps they felt it would take away the mystique of their books or something.
Or something, it might be, restrict their freedom of writing. I don't know. You know, when somebody writes a historical novel about the Civil War or something, they're kind of restricted to what actually happened, what battles were fought, where and when. If they're trying to write a novel, they have to conform to situations. And in science fiction, one of the things about it is that by, as often happens, putting everything in the future, you could make up whatever you want to. But if you have the UFO phenomenon front and center, it kind of puts a damper on what you feel you have to do. You don't have the freedom that you would have if there were no such things as UFOs flying around. That's just a theory of mine. I don't know.
What are you working on right now, and are you still actively involved with helping people who claim to have had abductions or feel that they may have had abductions?
Yes, I'm working with people in the way that I used to, except not in the same number, because the pool of energy is drying up a bit, I'm sad to say. At my next birthday, I'm going to be 79, which is a terrifying thought, if I make it, of course. But actually, I'm still working with people. I have somebody coming over in about 3.5 hours, 2.5 hours, for the preliminary interview, who feels that he may have had UFO experiences. And I've been dealing with a couple, actually from the UK, who have been to the United States several times, and both of them have had UFO experiences. And one of the things that happened, this is now perhaps a year ago, they went to bed, and when they woke up, the woman in the couple asked her lover, you know, what's happened to your shoulder? And there was a sort of raw opening, no blood, but it was essentially what we call a scoop mark, as if a whole sample of flesh had been removed. And he was intact when he went to bed, so it was hard to figure out any reason why this could have happened. She photographed the wound, which had, of course, had not bled, and yet when you looked at the thing, it looked as if you would have bled very copiously. So when they came to New York, and I was working with the two of them and doing it, well, essentially concentrating on the man, we took him to a doctor, a dermatologist, to examine the wound and took a sample of the the flesh around the edge, obviously trying to see if there's any kind of logical explanation of this. And nothing turned up, and the doctor himself was quite astonished by this whole thing turning up overnight, looking the way it did. But the couple apparently still have occasional UFO experiences. And I haven't seen them in about a year, I guess. Maybe
they,
a little
they
less.
They presumably have conscious experiences.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, just as an example, when he was a boy, he remembers, he was, I think, maybe 12. The family was, I believe, on summer vacation. And he would sleep usually till 9 o'clock or something like that. And he went to bed thinking, I have to get up early in the morning. I have to get up very early, without any idea about why that thought was in his mind. And he woke up at something like 5 o'clock and got dressed and went outside and went to a place nearby where houses were being built in some subdivision, and just knew he was supposed to go there and he was supposed to go into one of those houses. And he did. And the conscious memory too is that he's looking through an opening in the side of the house where the window would be installed eventually. This silver object, UFO, passed by the window. And he remembers a voice saying, everything's fine, don't worry. And the next thing he knows, it's, you know, 2 hours later, and he's going back home, not understanding where he's been exactly. He remembers where he's been. And he remembered the UFO and so forth, but he didn't know why any of this happened. But that was an early abduction experience that we explored, and there have been more explorations since then.
So you're still actively working with people, and do you still go and give talks at UFO meetings and groups?
I haven't been doing groups for quite a while. It's very time-consuming, and the arrangements have to be made and the phone calls, and then I used to have serve refreshments, and we would have a group that the largest was maybe, say, 20 people. But the whole project seemed to be finally wearing me down. And so this has also happened to David Jacobs, where he used to do these more frequently and sort of moved away from it. You know, we're doing all this for nothing, free. We're just giving up, you know, time out of our lives to do things like this. So it's just something that seems to be too much of a sacrifice nowadays.
No, I understand. You did mention to me that you are going to be going to California soon.
Yes, I'm going to be speaking at in Los Angeles at a MUFON conference, and then Orange County. I'm going there for a talk again, probably a day after the Los Angeles talk. So
when is that going to be?
I believe the dates are the 17th and 18th of February. I don't have my book with me, but I think those are the dates. And, you know, I still do a lot of presentations and, also radio broadcasts, such as we're doing now. And there's something on the internet called PowerCast, and I've done that several times. I did one just very recently, which is extremely interesting, with a man I had worked with a number of years ago, who's now, he's not coming forward with his full name, but he's willing to talk about his experiences, which were, in his case, very, very terrifying.
And that's something that's broadcast?
It's on the internet. It's called PowerCast. And it's actually a sort of a long thing, and I've done several of those recently.
Before we went on the air, you mentioned to me that you're doing a film.
Yes.
And what's that
about? So there's a documentary being made. We had a certain hiatus where no filming was being done because they were working on a film on Joan Rivers, the comedian, and that one that they're just completing, and it will be shown at the Sundance Festival, which is of course a very important venue for documentary filmmakers. Then they will come back to work on the film about Leslie and me. And the film essentially is about my work with the abductions phenomenon, but Leslie's work with witnesses, UFO witnesses, who are high-level government people or people who have done investigations for various countries. And some of the people she's working with, which she's writing, which will be a book next summer, and I assume it will be a very big book. But they involve people, for instance, generals who have had UFO experiences from different countries. One major case from Tehran back in 1976 under the Shah, when there was a dogfight between Major Jafari, now General Jafari, and the UFO, which was, he was sent up by the Air Force to intercept this thing and shoot it down. It's a very important case because it was covered by the Defense Intelligence Agency from an American perspective. But she's writing about this and General Jafari, and that some of that material will appear in the film eventually. But I'm looking forward to how the film works out.
And do you have any idea when that might be finished?
When the film comes out, we have no idea. They have shot a huge amount of footage. So how this will appear finally and how they will sort of boil all this material down to probably an hour film is something I don't know. Maybe an hour and a half or longer. But it's still up in the air because they have to see what they've got, and they haven't even had a chance to review the footage that they've taken.
Will you keep that posted on the Intruders?
Yes, it'll be on the Intruders website, which I should mention again. It's just Intruders Foundation at intrudersfoundation.org. Now, and we'll have new material on that.
Well, Bud, it's really been very, very pleasant and interesting talking to you. In closing, is there anything we didn't talk about that you really wanted to mention?
I'm sure there are things that I will remember in the next 10 minutes. And
well, we can always do it again, I think.
You'll think of questions that you didn't ask in the next 10 minutes, and that's the way it always is. But at any rate, it's been very fine, and it's been lots of fun talking and going over these things, which for the unsophisticated who are new to the subject, they'll probably tune us in and then tune us out with the idea that this is just impossible. That's the main reason why people simply can't accept this. Because they would tell you, well, I can't accept it because I can't accept it. It's just a kind of a rigid idea, belief system, that such things are impossible. But unfortunately, the belief system crumbles, and we're faced with the reality of it, and in all of its disturbing forms. It's a hard thing to live with, but we manage.
Well, I think the unknown can always be a little frightening. So your book, Art, Life, and UFOs, a Memoir by Bud Hopkins, very, very nice read, very interesting. And that is published by Anomalous Books?
Anomalous Books, yeah. And it's basically available to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Well, definitely, I would say a must read for people. It's really been lovely, Bud, and I hope we can talk again at some point in the future.
Well, I think that's quite possible.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all the very, very interesting work and the years and years of your time that you've put into this very relevant, I believe, very relevant subject.
Well, it's the most fascinating thing that one can imagine. It will be the biggest event once this becomes fully inevitable and accepted. It will be, of course, the biggest event in modern history.
Do you believe that we might be at the point of it being disclosed?
I don't think the disclosure idea of the government's going to disclose the truth and so forth, I don't think that will happen probably ever. What will happen is the public will just have more and more information, and there'll be more and more news stories and so on until the public accepts the reality of it. And it's going to be done by gradual steps, not by some kind of government announcement. The government has kept us quiet for so many years, and I think that it has its reasons. At this point, I can't imagine that there would suddenly be a reversal and they'll announce, yes, this is true. I've always said that if all the government, the president or whatever, could say is, and my fellow Americans, they're here, they're extraterrestrials, they have a program of abducting our adults and children, and they are carrying out some kind of program, and we have no idea what this will lead to. We have no idea what will finally be the outcome, whether they'll be friendly or not. But we'll let you know when we hear more about it. Thank you and good night. And I've always said if that were the case, that I would rather be in the liquor business than the stock market, say.
But I think now, surely, compared to when you first started looking into this, people would be less shocked, I think, all the films there have been and all the science fiction shows and the science fiction channel. Do you think it would be quite so shocking for people?
Oh, I think it would be extraordinarily shocking.
Really,
but
still?
I don't know. When you have a subject like global warming, which should be shocking to people, and people somehow lead their lives as if it's not real, I think that's kind of a model for the UFO phenomenon, too. It's something that is unthinkable, and it's in the future, quote-unquote. So it's just much harder for people to grasp. You know, we live in the present. We live day to day. And as long as we're not running into aliens or as long as the only people who are dying are polar bears and so forth, then life goes on. It's very hard for people to think long term. I think especially for Americans, perhaps. But at any rate, it's been fine talking, and I hope we can do this again.
Yes, definitely. Let's stay in touch, and perhaps when the film comes out, let me know, and we can
absolutely
come on and talk about that at that point too.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much, Emily.
And thank you, Bud.